The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the last of our Haycast from this year's Hay Festival. The weather has been, to say the least, rather changeable, but the quality of the guests who've appeared at the 21st Hay Festival has been reliably high. During the past 11 days, the Haycast has welcomed to our House of Hay everyone from Christopher Hitchens to Joanna Trollope, John Prescott to Tariq Ramadan. My own personal highlight was sitting in a room with Christopher Hitchens, Naomi Klein and George Monbiot, wondering if it was all going to get a bit personal. Coming up on today's programme, we'll be hearing from John Prescott, who dropped in to tell us why he thinks class still matters in today's Britain. There'll be music from the award-winning folk singer Seth Lakeman, and you'll find out what happened when I challenged the legendary Russian chess grandmaster Boris Spassky to a match.
I think very soon I'm going to kill you here.
But first, let me introduce you to my guest. Jonathan Powell was the former chief of staff at Number 10, Tony Blair's right-hand man, and one of the very few who were at Number 10 from the start to the very end of Blair's premiership. His book, Great Hatred, Little Room, details how Blair worked towards winning the peace in Northern Ireland. Philippe Sands has just written Torture Team, an expose of America's interrogation techniques. And Terry Jones, ex-Python, historian, writer, director, and cheerleader for Richard II, about whom he was talking at Hay just this morning. Terry, when I came out of your lecture, I just thought how brilliant it would have been if you'd been my history teacher. Did you have an alternate career that you had before you embarked upon comedy?
Well, I think all the way through grammar school, it was I always wanted to write. I just knew I wanted to write and act and do things like that. But I think after 5 years of grammar school, it had been drummed into me that you couldn't think of anything like that. The only thing you can do is teaching. So I kind of went up to university thinking, oh, God, that's what I'm going to do. But fortunately, I got away from school and so started fooling around.
Philippe, if you weren't putting away bad people, what would you be doing?
Well, that's a very tough question, but I think on the spot I'd say I'd be the next manager of Arsenal after Arsene Wenger, because I'm fascinated by the way he uses his budget, plots his strategy, and it's not altogether different from planning a case before the International Court.
Jonathan, what would you be doing if you weren't doing what you did for Tony Blair?
I'd like to be National Security Advisor to President Barack Obama.
I'm Ben Goldacre and I'm reading Testing Treatments by Ian Chalmers, the finest lay text on evidence-based medicine.
Well, one of the hottest tickets this weekend was with the legendary American writer John Irving. He was here to talk about his work and what it means to be a writer.
What you want to have in a first sentence is you want to walk in on someone. You want to turn your head and see something you shouldn't have seen. It's just a moment. And it's just a moment. The young Canadian, who could not have been more than 15, had hesitated too long. Uh-oh. Trouble. Right.
I'm Dan Cruikshank, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
So let's turn back to Jonathan Powell. Now, before I talk to you about the book itself, I'm quite interested in the fact that out of the three, you're the one probably least experienced in being in the front stage. You spent 11 years and the only idea that we had of what you looked like was one blurry black and white photograph. How does it feel to sort of emerge blinking into the spotlight and have people asking you questions and being exposed like that?
Actually, it gives you a lot more respect for practicing politicians because it's a lot harder than you think. It's easy to sit in the back room and say, you got it all wrong, you should have done this, you should have done that. But when you have to do it yourself, it's a lot harder.
And in terms of the book itself, a part of it seems to me that is you're trying to sort of argue the case, I guess, that Blair's legacy is not going to just be Iraq, it's also going to be Northern Ireland.
Well, I'm arguing a bit more than that. I mean, I think you have to give someone's legacy a bit of room to grow and perspective. I mean, you've had Jimmy Carter here this week. I think if you'd assessed Jimmy Carter the second he left office, he'd have had a fairly bad review. But interestingly, his reputation has increased substantially since he's left office. I think trying to make an assessment of Tony Blair's premiership now is ridiculous, really. You have to wait 10, 20 years, and then Iraq will be seen in perspective of other things, not just Northern Ireland, but Kosovo and all sorts of other achievements domestically.
Harry Jones.
Given Carter a bad press when he left office, I thought he was a terrific, I thought he was the best president they've ever had. You know?
No, but there's interesting market in these things. If you looked at what his poll ratings were when he left, they were absolutely terrible. If you looked at them now in America, they go up. Yeah, Bill Clinton has gone up and down over periods of time.
Yeah, if you go by the polls, I suppose, but I think you can have other assessments.
The hostage crisis was going on, though, wasn't it? Just around about the time.
When you
were immersing yourself in the 600 years ago history, does it feel long away or do you see parallels with now?
No, absolute parallels with now. I mean, that's one of the things that fascinates me about it. I think, you know, historians who talk about history as this thing that's happened and you can only understand it if you read my book about it, my interpretation, it seems so wrong because you see these people. I mean, Aristotle is writing, 380 BC, and he's describing everything, every political arrangement you can think of, and his politics is absolutely sophisticated. You see Richard II's reign, you've got the Hawks. He's trying to pursue a peace policy against the Hawks, and the Hawks are there because they're making money out of war, and that's, war, it doesn't change.
But Jonathan, I'm interested, what do you think was specific about the period in which Blair and just before that John Major were in power, which meant that peace was attainable, that it wasn't in the previous 20, 30 years?
Well, there were a number of different factors, but probably the most important was that both sides realised they couldn't win by military means. The British Army, after a disastrous start in Northern Ireland, had decided sometime by the late 70s, early 80s, that you couldn't win militarily. They could contain violence at what they called an acceptable level, but they could never actually beat the IRA. The IRA, after trying various different sorts of campaign, probably came to the same conclusion in the mid-80s. And by certainly the late 80s, Adams McGuinness were clearly trying to get out of it because they realised they weren't going to win militarily either.
You make a really interesting point that 9/11 in some ways actually helped that, because once you've got suicide bombers who are prepared to kill themselves, suddenly the IRA just don't seem quite so dangerous.
Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness deny the importance of 9/11, and from their own point of view, they're right. In terms of the areas they were coming from, 9/11 didn't persuade Irish Physical Force Republicans. They were wrong. But 9/11 clearly, there's competition in terrorism like anything else, and if there's someone who's more terrifying than you, that's prepared to blow themselves up, prepared to kill an infinite number of people, then you're no longer so terrifying and you can't compete.
And what do you think the lessons are for some of the security issues that we face now with Al-Qaeda, etc.?
Well, the one conclusion I drew, particularly from writing the book and going back actually over the practice of the British government through the 1970s, 80s and 90s, where they were conducting secret contacts with the IRA throughout that period, is and those contacts were crucial in actually bringing about the ceasefire in 93, 94. I think that what one should do is talk to these people. You've got to find a way of establishing a contact. Talking to them doesn't mean negotiating with them. It doesn't mean conceding to them. And I think George Bush's comments the other day about appeasement are just sort of misplaced, misunderstanding the history of things.
Philippe.
I was very interested by that because I interviewed Jimmy Carter on Sunday night at the festival. And one of the questions I asked him was, is there anyone you wouldn't talk to? And the only group he mentioned was Al-Qaeda. And I didn't have time to press him on it. But I must say, I'm absolutely with you. I think politically right now, a former Democratic president cannot say the time is ripe to speak to Al-Qaeda.
Terry?
No, I mean, nobody says that the state of Israel is founded on terrorism from, what was going on before the George V Hotel and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you've got to talk in the end.
Now, somebody else with first-hand experience of government at the most highest of levels is John Prescott, the former Deputy Prime Minister. He's just brought out a memoir which has attracted a fair few headlines with his surprising admission to having battled with bulimia. I spoke to him on Friday, just before his event here. John Prescott, is this going to be your first appearance in front of a book festival audience?
Yes, it certainly is. I've never been associated with books. A lot of people doubt I even read them, but this is the first time here, yes.
Are you a bit nervous about what they might ask? Because ordinary people can ask questions politicians don't normally have to face from
interviewers. No, I think that's one of the good things. I've done a couple of launches of the books where we've had questions yesterday, and it's good. They want to ask the questions that they think is important. I try to be honest about the replies, and a good atmosphere appears to develop from it. Except when the Daily Mail turns up, of course.
So the book was, it was ghost-written, but at the same time, you had to talk a lot. You must have had to remember a lot of memories. What was it like dredging those memories back out?
Funny enough, not difficult at all. I'd made clear in the book, this wasn't a book about how whole Labour and New Labour got on about policies. It was about my life, and which started well before I became a politician. And it was also important, I think, for people to read this book and make a judgment of me, which I don't think the press has been particularly fair about.
Did you learn anything in remembering stuff and then finally reading the book? Did you think, there's something about me that I didn't even know until Hunter pulled it out of me?
Not about me. I think it was generally, as perhaps for me telling the story, it's not surprising I'm telling as I see it. But about my wife, I did, I think. She runs as a thread right through this book and shows herself to be far mature than me in certain times. And terrible to say I should be so surprised, but I was, and it's right.
You're quite an interesting contradiction, aren't you? One side, you've got somebody who, will thump a stranger. But then there's another side which you'll reveal about, for example, about bulimia, which isn't an easy thing for somebody like yourself to have talked about,
well,
surely.
Well, it wasn't hard either. And I think the people, when they said it was brave and courageous, I don't think it was for a moment. I just wanted people to know that was a kind of problem that I had and dealt with. And if you say I'm pulling no punches, I can't write a book that isn't about important developments in the life. I tried to be honest in the book. It was kind of opening the debate. It's a kind of thing that nobody wants to talk about.
You mentioned having more than one chip on your shoulder, and class is another thing, which is, you know, you're quite exceptional in many ways for somebody who has genuinely come from a working class background and then reached right up to the top of the Labour Party. And when you look today at Britain, not just in politics, but Britain, is class still as big a factor as it always was?
That's a very interesting question. The reality is, and John Harris, I think, in your paper, has been writing that 7% of the population have private education, but if I take the media, something like 50 to 60% have private education. It's the same with the judges, in some cases with the cabinet and the politicians. So the establishment, the peak of the pyramid, are still 70% who've bought network, who've bought privilege, and the rest of us are in that serving capacity. And social mobility has become less and less.
You're signing for I say so, more like a deputy prime minister than an author there. Do you miss power?
No. I was very privileged to get 10 years as the longest serving deputy prime minister and to do many things that I wanted to about the employment, the poverty, things I've done myself, Kyoto, which I think is important. Perhaps I could put it like this to you. Perhaps I'm talking like the ordinary guy. Tony used to say to me, particularly after that egg incident where I connected with the electorate, he used to say to me, I said, if an ordinary guy had done this, Tony, what would you say? He said, you're not an ordinary guy, you're the Deputy Prime Minister. And I said, well, if an ordinary guy can't be a Deputy Prime Minister, stick your job.
Okay, hand on heart, do you think Labour's done for?
No. God blimey, how many times have we read that all over the place? Look, journalists like the dramatic to politics and they think it's finished. It's not a good position we're in. We're just a good kick up the backside, both with the London elections, the local election and the by-election. We have to regain that confidence of the public. I don't think it's that they've given us a warning, and I'm sure Gordon Brown's well aware of that. He'll come through a difficult period. He's still the best man, though, to take us through that period.
I'm Misha Glennie, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
Let's turn now to Philippe Sands. Now, your book, Torture Team, it's kind of revolves around exactly what you were just talking about before, isn't it? About torture and its consequences. But you centre around one particular document that was signed by Rumsfeld, which at the time was almost ignored, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't public. It only came out in the aftermath of when the Abu Ghraib pictures were published, and the administration needed to spin a narrative to basically say, we don't do that sort of thing. And I followed a very different approach from what I'd done in my last book. I was interested in the minutiae of one document authorising the interrogation of one man.
What do you assess as the ripples? What does it do to America's legitimacy?
It's catastrophic. It's been absolutely catastrophic, and not just for the US, for the United Kingdom also. I mean, I act right now probably about 20 governments around the world. I've been in a room, you know, with a president. I've been in a room with a foreign minister where they will refer to legal advices given by senior lawyers in the Bush administration authorising these techniques. And the next thing that I'll be said is, and why is Britain turning a blind eye? And it's something, obviously, I would love to talk about with Jonathan, because it may or may not be true. We'll have a little more time, no doubt. It may or not be true, but the perception is that basically Tony Blair's head was up George Bush's arse and turning a blind eye to absolutely everything. Prime Minister just folded.
Jonathan.
Well, I didn't see it like that. I mean, torture point, I mean, I don't remember that ever having been raised with us directly by the Americans and go around saying, would you like to approve of torture? Because they've got a fairly clear answer from that. In terms of having his head up George Bush's arse, no. But the question is, would it have been better if the Americans had gone ahead without the Brits? Would that somehow have made the invasion of Iraq right? Would it have made American position any easier? I think the position of being a firm ally of the United States was the right position.
But we wouldn't have been a terrorist a target for terrorism if we hadn't joined the United States.
Oh, yes, we would. I mean, the people in Bali weren't exactly joining the United States and invading Iraq, and they got a bomb. So why would that?
Why does that mean
it happened in Germany too?
Why would we be a terrorist target? Why are people in Bali? That doesn't answer the question, though.
Well, it does, because the point is they're going to attack anyone. It doesn't matter whether you're ally with them or not.
I think it's a very fair question to ask. I mean, are you better inside the tent or outside the tent? It's a question we all ask ourselves. It's a very legitimate question. But when the president turns around to the prime minister and says on the 31st of January 2003, the bombing starts on the 10th of March, irrespective of whether or not we've got a second resolution, and the prime minister says, I'm solidly with you, Mr. President, basically, I'm with you whether or not we've got a resolution, the next 6 weeks became sort of irrelevant. The decision had been taken.
Jonathan.
No, that's not quite right. I mean, you have to put yourself back in the context of the time and how these things developed. I mean, this didn't come out of nowhere. We'd been 10 years at this. We'd had the original Gulf War. We then had the inspectors in there. The inspectors had been thrown out. One of the first things we did in coming to government, of course, was bombing Iraq along with Clinton after the inspectors had been thrown out. And then we had a series of resolutions in the UN. So this has been a battle we'd gone through for a long, long time. And then this train started. We managed to get the Americans into the UN route against, you know, almost over Cheney's dead body. We then managed to get the progress towards a second resolution, which they really didn't want. We were pushing all the time to do that, but to get them to go along that path, we had to be with them. You couldn't be against them and get them to go down that path. That was the choice.
You're sitting there with a man, the President of the United States, described by his own press secretary 2 days ago as a self-deceiving incompetent. Did you not see that?
No, I don't think that's a fair criticism at all. I don't think people don't become President of the United States if they're self-deceiving incompetence.
I just want to ask one question to Philippe. How complicit do you think the British were in what was going on in America, and how much do you think that how involved do you think they were, and morally as well?
I mean, I think one's got to draw a distinction between different aspects. I think on Iraq, we the British are totally complicit. We are absolutely as responsible. I think the jury's still out on the stuff that I've been looking at. There is evidence beginning to emerge of British involvement in renditions. I need to be careful what I say. There's a case that's coming up, and we have a convention that we don't talk about cases that we're involved in. Let me put it like this. I would not be surprised at all if material emerges which shows that the highest echelons of the British government in the period after September the 11th decided to turn a blind eye to material that was not helpful. I'm thinking in particular of interrogations in Pakistan. I'm thinking in particular of decisions to transfer individuals to countries where torture and other forms of abuse were used. I'm not for a moment saying Jonathan is involved in that. Absolutely not.
Jonathan, what would be your response to what Philippe has just said?
I would be very surprised indeed if there's any evidence appeared that showed that any of that had been approved at the highest levels of the British government.
I think I chose my words very carefully. I suggested it was turning a blind eye.
Well, sorry, turning a blind eye to such stuff, I would also be extremely surprised.
I am Owen Colfer, and I am reading Cold Mountain by Charles Fraser because it passed my browse the bookshelf and read the first page test, which I do quite a lot. So this one is just fantastic. It's very lyrical, it's beautiful, but also it tells the truth about the Civil War and the heart. It's a very powerful anti-war statement. And it's a beautiful love story as well. So it has a lot of elements that come together in a beautiful, lyrical, poetical way. So Cold Mountain by Charles Fraser, highly recommended.
Now, one of the most surreal experiences in the last week was when I met Boris Spassky. He's probably most famous for playing Bobby Fischer in the chess match that many hold up as the match of the century, not least for its Cold War symbolism. Fischer, the young American challenger, Spassky, the Soviet champion. I met Spassky, and being an amateur chess player myself, I couldn't resist challenging the old master to a game.
So, this isn't quite Reykjavik 1972. This is Hay on Wye 2008. But Boris Spassky, the idea behind this is we'll talk, but we'll talk whilst playing a game of chess. And when you beat me, that's when the questions stop. How does that sound?
I'm ready. Yeah, okay. I'm ready to play.
Are you confident?
I'm very confident.
Well, you beat 20 people in one go yesterday, didn't you?
No, it was not so difficult, I can tell you.
Do you normally play white, or do you normally play black, or do you not mind?
Only white. Only white.
Okay, all right.
No, but you can take white if you like.
Okay, well, I hope that doesn't give me an unfair advantage. Okay, I'm going to go for my queen's pawn, and I'm going to move it two.
Okay, yes, please.
So you're moving your knight there. I read somewhere that you started playing chess because you were on a train leaving Leningrad in 1944. Is that true?
July 41, maybe after 2 weeks when the war started. I was very lucky to survive because the first train was bombed. I was in the second. The third train with the children also was bombed. So you can see that I'm very lucky chess player.
It's your move.
Yes, may move, so please.
I think something is being plotted and I'm not quite sure. I think I've just moved my bishop and made it check there.
Yes.
Well, I had you check for one move though, didn't I, there?
This is the reason why I protected my king.
You moved your pawn in front. When you were a world champion in the Soviet Union at that time, was it a bit like being a big film actor or being a rock star? Was it? Did you get that level of celebrity?
No, at that time it was higher, even higher. I didn't like fame, I can tell you. I always preferred to have my private life.
It's your move.
That's my move, yes. I'm still looking for the best. Yes, I found something. Check! I feel myself now very comfortable. In 1963, when I became quite strong, I said to my coach, I used to call him Father, Father, what do you think if I become next world champion? He said, oho, I like it. So that was the beginning of my chess career.
It's not going brilliantly. A lot of people think about the 72, your confrontation with Bobby Fischer. It's been source of books, there's been so much talking about it. How much of a disappointment was the result with Bobby Fischer?
I was disappointed with myself when in the game number 3, I think I made a psychological mistake and practically I lost the match already in the third game.
There was a lot of psychological games being played at that time.
Bobby, as you remember, he used to make some eccentric actions. He didn't appear for the ceremony of the opening of the match.
And he didn't want television cameras there, did he?
He didn't want the television camera as well, yeah.
And was he worried that there were people trying to hypnotize him in the audience as well?
No, no, I don't believe in this. No, no.
So it's your move. I've just moved my king out of the danger zone because you were putting me in check with your queen.
Oh, yes, I see that. You're absolutely hopeless.
You've just...
but it doesn't matter because you decided to play this just for fun.
I'm trying my best. How does playing chess change as you get older?
I would say that now I don't have any ambitions at all. I don't play serious competitions. I think very soon I'm going to kill you here.
Are you going to beat me in chess before that?
Opa.
There's been mass carnage here.
Sorry, almost.
Right, you've put me into...
This is checkmate, yes.
It is checkmate, it's not checkmate.
You don't have any move.
This is it. This is the end of the game and it's the end of the interview then. Well, Boris Spassky, it's been a pleasure to lose to you. And thank you. Thank you for giving me a game.
You're welcome.
So that was Boris Spassky. Jonathan, is politics at the highest level like chess?
Well, I'm a lousy chess player, so I'm not sure I'd compare it exactly with chess. But strategy, yes. A successful politician is the one who can keep his eye on the strategic goal, because it's so easy to get distracted by tactical games, because people will start tactical games and you follow them along. You should really ignore those as best you can and just stay fixed on your ultimate aim.
And Philippe, last night you were telling me that you try and crowbar Monty Python references into your cases.
I do. I'm so thrilled to be here with Terry Jones. I simply cannot tell you. One of my most recent cases, a boundary dispute that has gone on for 70 years since the colonial period, Suriname versus Guyana. I'm for Guyana. And in my closing speech, I invoked the Black Knight. And the Black Knight is, of course, the gentleman in the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail who is defending a small stream crossing for no apparent reason. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to discover that Terry Jones may have been the person who wrote those words for no apparent reason. And then, of course, what happens to the Black Knight is one by one, each of his limbs is chopped off. And I used this to, I think, destroy Suriname's arguments. And I brought a fantastic reaction from the Australian judge on the tribunal.
I have to say that it's John and Graham's sketch. I have to make this quite clear. But it's possible when we were doing the screenplay that I inserted the words in the stage directions.
Terry, you managed to get some Python references into your lecture this morning. You were talking about Richard II, and you made a joke about how he's sometimes people forget him and they remember Richard I and the Third. Why did you want to choose Richard II to rescue rescue him from history?
Oh, well, I didn't choose him. He chose me, really. I mean, I'd been sort of working on Chaucer, and so I'm very interested in Chaucer's disappearance within a couple of months of Richard II's murder. And what was going on, the change in the power from what I think was a fairly enlightened court under Richard II. And it's just when you see an injustice being done, even though it was done 600 years ago, you just can't keep quiet about it. And I just felt that Richard II has been misrepresented.
Tell me about blank charters. I found them quite interesting.
The blank charters, well, they were very... it's a bit difficult to describe, really, because they were not blank charters. In fact, they were charters of carte blanche, and it was really giving the king freedom to do whatever he liked. Now, that sounds a pretty scary thing to us nowadays.
Sounds like the sort of thing Philippe was talking
sounds
about.
Sounds like a Security Council resolution.
But the thing was, in the Middle Ages, they distinguished between a king and a tyrant, not by how much power the king, the person, held, but by what he did with that power. Really, you wanted power in the hands of one person. It was that was the theory, that it was actually better to have power. But it was how you had access to that person, how you educated that person was the important things, rather than what we think of as a democracy.
Jonathan, do you sometimes think about, in years to come, that people will be writing about you and Blair as historical characters, and, you know, you'll be seen as a historical character rather than a person?
Yes, well, that starts rather earlier than it did in Richard II's reign. And I remember Tony, after the film The Queen, went to Florida, and he went into a restaurant and someone came up to him and said, "I loved you in that film." So people take the fiction of these things quite, you know, long before Shakespeare. What's interesting about Terry's book is the revisionism that you get, because you take George III, who was always considered the worst king ever, and then they decided actually wasn't so bad after all. But Richard II never has really had any revision. He's been stuck, hasn't he?
Interesting thing. You've come back twice to this theme. There's two people you've now mentioned, George III and Jimmy Carter, as people who immediately after their reign somehow didn't look so great, and then with the passage of time. Is this really digging away? Is this digging away?
I think Tony looks a bit better than either of them.
Now, all week we've been running a competition asking if you could see anybody at the Hay Festival, who would it be? And I have pre-warned my three guests about this, to their alarm. So if you could ask anybody to appear at Hay, who would it be?
Oh, well, I suppose I've got to say Geoffrey Chaucer. I mean, it'd be such a... I'd hate to meet him, because I think I'd probably be disillusioned, you know, he'd be sitting there drinking away and probably wouldn't have much to say for himself, but I'd have to.
Well, I would actually, if asked by the run of the Hay Festival, who I would want more than anyone, it would be a sort of small room with Leonard Cohen singing. I know that's not going to happen, and I know that sounds really pathetic compared to Chaucer, but I'm devoid of imagination when it comes to these things.
No, my Irish theme, it would be Lloyd George. I'd like to ask why we got in this mess in the first place, and why. Surely they could have done something else rather than give in to the orange card at that stage, because Britain's been responsible for so many of the unsolved problems around the world, from the Middle East to Kashmir to this. Surely we could have done a bit better when we were leaving places.
I'm now trying to imagine what it'd be like if we had Chaucer, Leonard Cohen, and Lloyd George sitting around here. Doesn't bear thinking.
No, what do you mean it doesn't bear thinking about? It would be an extraordinary experience.
Lloyd George wasn't the one doing the singing, and Leonard
Cohen. He can't sing worse than me.
Now we've got a couple of selections. A number of people suggested J.D. Salinger, Lord Lucan. Tom Gifford suggested William Burroughs, just for the pleasure of hearing his croaky drawl. We've got a short list of three. Gary Snyder said he'd like to, for having one of being the original Beat Firebrands, hanging out with Ginsberg, mountaineering with childhood, the cause of the entire Kerouac novel, Dharma Bums. You've got one as well, have you, Terry?
Oh, yes, there's one here from Michael F. And who says he'd like to have Homer here. He says it would be great. Perhaps no one would turn up. Perhaps a couple of hundred guys would file up onto the platform. Perhaps he might actually turn out to be a woman.
We don't think this is Homer Simpson he's talking about, do we?
I don't think so. No, I don't.
Apparently, our winner, who will receive a magnificent Guardian deck chair, it is actually quite magnificent. We've had everyone who's appeared signing it. So it's an illustrious list of people who've been signing it. And it's somebody who comes under the name called, they call themselves Diagonal Argument. So Mr. and Mrs. Argument have named their child Diagonal. And they've said, I'd love to see Haruki Murakami in the flesh and listen to him discuss his books, jazz, and the perfect way to cook spaghetti. Actually, scratch all of those. I think Murakami would be able to talk for several hours on the topic of earloaves, given that they recur in his book so often. So yes, a talk by Murakami on the subject of earlobes. Well, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Jonathan Powell, Terry Jones and Philippe Sands. And that pretty much wraps up things for another year. I hope you've had as much fun listening to the Haycast as we've all had in making them. We leave you with the acclaimed folk musician Seth Lakeman, who brought his fiddle when he came by the House of Hay earlier in the week and played us a song from his latest album.
Sunday morning in the summertime, all the worship we had this climb over mountains and valleys deep, those bells are ringing around our feet.
I play a fiddle, stamp my foot and sing quite loudly over the top of a driving violin. They're quite urgent and it's quite in your face when it's played. There's nothing polite about it.
But you started playing really young, didn't you?
Yeah, very, very early on. My parents used to run a folk club actually in Plymouth. So I was lucky enough to have huge influence when I was sort of from, I guess, seven onwards, hanging out in these folk clubs with all sorts of people from Martin Carthy to Roger Wilson to Tom McConville, all these great folk artists coming through the house and hopefully leaving a bit of their, you know, expertise along the way.
Curse was rising, we were trapped, oh, the boys, come on, make a choice. And he said, oh, you other boys, make a choice.
Do you think folk music still has its soul in the same way if it gets reappropriated by a new generation?
I think so. It's an exciting time for folk music, I think. English folk music, it's always had quite a stereotype. And hopefully, you know, new acoustic artists like Kate Rusby and Cara Dillon, myself and Liza Carthy, and even people in the mainstream like Katie Tunstall, and are hopefully shedding some light and breaking down some barriers.
And he said, oh, you are the boys, well, come on, make a choice. And he said, oh, you are the boys, make a choice.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.